This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. He's the longest-serving House Speaker in state history. And last week, we found out he's leaving the Indiana General Assembly at the end of this month, though we've known of his intentions to do so since Organization Day last November. He's been closely involved in some of the most significant and newsworthy legislative accomplishments of the last few decades, including major moves, right to work, school vouchers, property tax caps, and many, many more that we hope to get to this hour. So let's not waste any more time. Speaker Brian Bosma, welcome to All In.
Hi, Matt. Very nice to be here with you today.
And of course, we welcome your input this hour. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Try to keep your questions and comments brief so that we can fit as many of them in this hour as possible. So, Speaker Bosma, you've been Speaker for the last 12 of 16 years. And again, that makes you the longest serving Speaker in the House in history. How does that feel?
Well, my joke has been, Matt, that after 6 years, they either hang them or run them out of town. And somehow I
you
I
doubled that.
You know, it's been mixed, bittersweet, I guess is the right way to say it. So Cheryl and I, in 34 years of service, we didn't have children. We were just married. We didn't have children. Had two great adult kids married now and pursuing careers. You know, we lost three parents and a sibling in that time. I've been to Haiti a couple of times. Just so much has transpired on top of all of the political accomplishments. It's been a time to reflect and take a victory lap. I've enjoyed that. And still, even today, received a number of emails from people who just wanted to thank me for affecting their lives in some fashion. So it's been good. Feel good about the work we've done, feel great about the shape that we left the state in, and now in unprecedented challenges, wishing the governor and Speaker Houston and President Pro Tem Bray the very best as they take on the unprecedented challenges that are lying ahead.
Of course, you made the decision last year, and you're leaving now. Why now?
You know, it was just time. My law practice at Kroger, Gardis & Regas has been extremely busy. I'm currently serving, again, this is a repeat for me, as the chair of a national Republican Legislative Campaign Committee group that's seeking to bring keep majorities for Republicans throughout the country. And it's just been extremely busy. And it was just the right time for someone else to step in. And Chris Jeter won the primary. I actually was going to step down right after the primary and let the person who was elected in the primary step in the role. But the primary got pushed to June. Party leaders asked me not to step down because they didn't know how they could have a replacement caucus right away without people in the same room. So it's time for me to do it now. So I feel a lot of gratitude, honestly, for the people we worked with, the staff I've worked with, the Hoosiers and District 88 that have sent me back to the State House 17 times, and all my colleagues.
So you're going to remain in politics. No surprise there. You grew up around politics. Your father, Charles Bosma, served in the state Senate for 18 years. And I actually spoke with former state Senator Bob Garton this morning on the phone. He served with your father, and he called Charlie Bosma the conscience of the Senate. He said he was firm, but always willing to listen to the other side. How did your dad help shape your perspective?
You know, my dad, certainly, but dad and mom both were public servants, dad, first on the battlefield and then in the legislature, mom in the classroom for her entire life. And they both placed a very high premium on public service, and literally dinner table discussions were about current events, the state of our state, the state of our nation, and how we would give back in some way. And each of the three of us kids, the two older sisters, one deceased now, gave back in one way. Jan was a lifetime civil servant, working both for the city and the state. My sister Rhonda was taught originally at the School for the Deaf here in Indianapolis, and then in California and Maryland, teaching multiply handicapped kids, and myself through a few venues, the elected public service, the establishment of Bosma Industries for the Blind, and some other things that we've done along the way. been fortunate to have a great spouse who has supported that, great kids who grew up like I did with a parent in politics and seemed to maintain normalcy throughout all of that. So, yeah, so mom and dad made a real difference. When I explain my dad, I half jokingly say he was a captain in the European theater, and when he gave an order, it had underlying behind it, there are officers behind you prepared to shoot. So he wasn't exactly a feel-good guy, but I frequently cite what he once said to me, and members of my legislative team heard it often, and that was, when faced with a tough decision, just do what's right and let the politics shake out for itself. And that I'll attribute that one solely to my dad teaching me that one.
Are politics the same now as they were when he was involved in them?
No, I think it's become, it's not even the same as it was when I was first elected in 1986. It's become not necessarily the participants, the elected officials and party leaders, but with the advent of social media, it used to be if somebody had to pick a bone with you, they had to find you or they could write you a letter. Now people can, place comments on social media without any basis whatsoever. And I think it's become very hateful, in all honesty. I try not to look at it. The tradition of Hoosiers, especially setting all those differences aside and stepping into a part-time legislative role, which has become more full-time than most would like, and then getting the work done on time, and on budget and going back into the community, that's an honorable one. And the hundreds and maybe a thousand, I haven't counted, of individuals that I've served with over the years, everyone wanted to make Indiana a better place. They may have very different ideas about how to do that, but they all come for the same reason. I will tell you that even during my 34 years, when I was first elected, John Gregg, another speaker who was a law school classmate of mine, five or six other Democrat legislators and one or two other Republicans, we were all pretty much so best of friends during the legislative session. And you'd get up and debate and everybody would go out and have a beer or talk about family or whatever. That has changed to a certain degree in Indiana because of the divisiveness of some of the issues we've dealt with. We've had two 50-50 splits. We had the longest walkout in our state's history, or in the nation's history, actually. And so some of those things have changed, but all in all, people just want to do what's right for the state.
I mean, what would you say on that subject, I guess, about to people who might be quick to comment and be really negative and, as you say, hateful online? How can we bring things back to a tamer place?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Matt, that that's retrievable given the social media conduct of people at this point. Hmm. I think just adults have to ignore it and try to find middle ground, which I've done throughout my career, although some would say not only the only legislative leader in our state's history that's actually appointed members of the opposite party to committee chairs. First did that in 2011 to gasps from both sides of the aisle. And I did it on three separate two-year sessions, a total of seven committee chairs. We need to have more of that outreach, more of that across the aisle work, and less of the vitriol that seems to be coming, perhaps in part with 24-hour news and some of the other developments over the last 20 years.
You were in your seat for 18 years before you became speaker. At that time, in 2004, how did you know you were ready?
So I've actually been an elected leader in the House for 26 years. I was elected in 1994 after 8 years in the legislature as the floor leader, the number two person in the majority floor leader, actually, in 94, the principal spokesperson for Republicans on the floor of the House when Paul Manweiler was speaker, and then continued in that role as floor leader until 2000, when Representative Manweiler stepped down. and assumed the Republican leadership role and was the minority leader for 4 years. I had served with, at that point, with seven different speakers, and I knew what I would do if I had the chance to lead. And ultimately, in 2004, I got the chance, and hopefully have set our state on the right course here for a long time to come.
Well, it sounds like it was a smooth enough transition at the very least. I guess during your time in House leadership, here comes a standard question: what do you consider to be some of your biggest failures?
You know, there isn't a whole lot I would change. I will tell you that I would probably have been a little less caustic, perhaps even to some of the leaders in my own party. I have a hilarious, I would say, some would say somewhat acerbic sense of humor, and I can rib just a little bit too hard sometimes, and I would take a little bit of that back. Actually, I would specifically take it back with our Vice President, Mike Pence. It was all good-natured, but because I had done some of this public jostling with Mike over some issues, somebody wrote a book about what enemies we are. I've been out to see Mike twice in his office out in D.C., and I hope to see him Friday when he's in town, actually. And I would dial a little bit of that back. So like everyone else probably in America, maybe in the world, we've been cleaning things out. And we sent all of our old videos to Legacy Box. Are you familiar with this group? They will digitize everything. Hmm. And Cheryl and I sat down last night for the first time to plug in the thumb drive and watch some of our videos from when our kids were really small. I was a little bit of a smart aleck. Cheryl was laughing. I was even irritating myself. Listening back to some of my smart aleck comments. So that would be the thing I would roll back. There really weren't any votes I cast or actions I took that I'd look back and say, boy, that was an error. I'm sure there are some I could think of, but none that I thought, boy, did we ever make a huge mistake afterwards.
House Speaker Brian Bosma is our guest today. He's retiring from the Indiana General Assembly next Friday, July 31st, and we're fortunate to have him for the whole hour today. And there's still a lot to talk about, of course, so stay with us. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in just under 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're spending the hour with Brian Bosma, the longest-serving House Speaker in the history of the Indiana General Assembly. We found out last week that he's officially leaving at the end of the month, next Friday. So we thought we would take a look back at his most noteworthy moments in the Indiana House of Representatives. And we welcome your questions and comments this hour for the Speaker. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. So let's get into some of those moments. So one thing that you pushed for was daylight saving time. Governor Daniels called for it as soon as he took office, but it was a debate, to be sure. And when it passed, it did so narrowly. What do you remember about that debate?
So that's very much so in my mind. I'll tell you the behind the scenes story that I don't believe I've stated publicly. So when we had the votes, we'd counted votes. There were folks from business interests, the chambers, everybody had counted votes, and there were 60 votes to support the change for business reasons. And yes, was there inconvenience for some folks? My mother never liked it because she couldn't change her VCR. and yes, it's a problem. But subsequently, I'm going to jump ahead and say the result was we had huge investment in Indiana. Nestle's big plant up 69. They said at the groundbreaking for that they would not have come to Indiana without that change, because they would have had to have a special computer fix around the world just to take care of Indiana. So it was a brilliant, brilliant move. Mitch called for it. I called for it. We moved forward. So Pat Bauer, I was a speaker. Pat Bauer was the minority leader, and Pat was adamantly opposed to it. And we opened the machine for our 60 votes, and there were 55. And then Pat Bauer started walking around on the floor, and people started changing their vote on the spot. And we got down below 50 to 49 votes. And I froze the machine but left it open for – actually, I didn't freeze the machine. I left the machine open for about 15 minutes. Very unusual. They do it in Congress all the time. It's a 10-second vote in Indiana, you know, almost every time. So I left the machine open for 15 minutes and nothing changed. We took a break, went to caucus, and I had a list of people, and I kind of gave a, you know, you need to do one for the Gipper here speech, and had three or four people in mind. Mitch Daniels called me during that, and he said, "Brian, this is just too much. Pull the plug. We can't do this." And I said, "Governor, I'll tell you right now, I have spent too much personal capital on this. So we either with members who are voting yes because I've asked them to. So we've got to bring this thing home." So I had three people in mind who I wanted to vote for it. They could vote for it politically, and it wasn't a problem. And we went back, and I gave my, you know, let's do this for the Gipper and the governor and me, and let's go down there and do it. So we go down there. Machine opens. One person changes their vote, so we have 50 votes for it at this point. And apparently Representative Bauer can't change any more no's. And at that time, we have a new system. At that time, you could flip a switch and lock the machine, and no one could change their vote. So I see 51 votes. My parliamentarian says 51 votes. I flip the switch, lock the machine, tally the roll, and I said, "Who was it?" And there was one, and of course, his name is escaping me now. I see his face. He was from southern Indiana, and it was the death knell for him. We knew if he voted yes, and I specifically asked him not to vote yes. But afterwards, I said he was a Marine, former Marine. He saw a grenade, and he jumped on it. So we knew that vote and the toll road vote would likely land us in the minority, and we decided to do both of those issues anyway. My favorite commercial afterwards, there was a guy from northwestern Indiana who lost the election, a member of our caucus. His name was Steve Heim. And the political team said, "Hey, we want you to listen to a commercial that's running up in Steve Heim's district here the week before the election." And it was a little girl saying, "Mommy, why do I have to go to bed?" And she says, "Well, honey, we're on Heim time." "What's Heim time?" "Oh, Steve Heim voted to put us in the same time as New York City." Oh, it was actually hilarious. And the little girl said, "I hate Heim time. I'm not going to vote for Steve Heim." And Mom says, "Neither am I, honey. Vote for whoever it was." And Steve actually lost the election, as did the guy down from southwestern Indiana. So we came back in the minority. But those two measures were brilliant business moves, both orchestrated by Mitch Daniels. And, you know, we still have the positive benefits of both the toll road deal and daylight savings time today.
Well, and to look a little bit later, another highlight was leading the initiative to cut and cap property taxes. And you did that as House Minority Leader in 08. How much of a challenge was that at that time?
It was a big challenge, but it seems like ancient history now. There were people in the Butler-Tarkington area who had gone from like a $2,000 tax bill to $7,000 or $9,000 tax bill. And many of these people were on fixed incomes. So the plan to cut and then ultimately cap property taxes, which then we expanded on when we took the majority again, we now have the lowest homeowner property taxes in America. So that, again, is one of the 15 tax cuts in 16 years that my team championed and effectively enacted cuts or out and out repeals. So, and that one has to rank near the top as far as impacting Hoosiers every day.
Well, the Great Recession, though, was ramping up at that time. How much do you think timing played a role in rallying both sides for that legislation?
Well, you know, the recession gave us a lot of challenges. We were one of the few states in the nation that did not cut education in the legislature. Now, Mitch held some money back, and he had to make the books balance, but California cut education like 22% or some outrageous number, and I think we might have had a 3% cut in education and cut all other areas of state government. So, I mean, one of the things people don't realize about the conservative legislative and administrative executive leadership that we've had, we've paid off billions of dollars of debt. We were still paying debt in 16 on an Evan Bay bond issue that generated money for roads that have long since been repaved. So it's not a criticism of him. It was just super long debt. And we paid off state office building debt. We have the second lowest per capita debt by the state government in the nation. And that's one of the reasons, in addition to healthy reserves, which is one of the reasons we are going to come out of this unprecedented fiscal challenge that we have right now in at least good shape, because of the very faithful fiscal stewardship of, not to be political, but it's been Republicans who have said no to a lot of the spending and paid down pensions and paid down debt so we don't look like Illinois does today. So I'll take some credit and pride in that as well.
Well, along those lines, I mean, there has been spending, though, and that segues us into education reform, school vouchers, school choice. Obviously, it's being utilized. So there's no question that some people are taking advantage. It's expansive, but it's also expensive, and its opponents are very vocal. Test scores have declined. Teachers, by and large, are not big fans. What would you say to someone, I guess, who argues that we're moving in the wrong direction there?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're not looking at the data properly, or they're believing some of the propaganda that some of the unions put out. So the way we put this together, and I was the champion of it for the school vouchers, is a family who's going to receive a school voucher doesn't get the full amount of the money that would go to the local school. They get 80% of it. And the local school that they would go to, it still gets run through the formula. So it is not expensive. There's something like 3% of the families, the school children are in it, and it uses 2% of the money allocated. So it actually, it is not an expansive and expensive program. It is expansive because we have more than 42,000 families on it. And our Constitution says the legislature shall provide public education by any means, by every means possible, which is why our plan was ruled constitutional under the state constitution. So there, the local classroom in public school is absolutely right for so many families. For some families, it's not right. And I've sat down with families, low-income families, who, you know, one of the parents is crying, usually the dad, that he never thought he could give their child the opportunity to go to a Christian school or a private school or another public school that they can't afford to live in that neighborhood or in that school district. So it's been good. And those who are uber critical of it, I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, but those who are uber critical are being uber critical for a reason and a point, not because the program's not working. The program's working. It's working well. And at the same time, we have greatly expanded funding for public schools with some of the largest increases, the last three budgets in state history. In real dollars. Now, is it enough? No. Do we spend more on education as a percentage of our income than all but four states in the nation? Yes. It's 52% of all state funds go to our K-12 public schools. So, and when you add our public universities on it, on top of it, 64% of the state budget. So it's top priority for everyone. But the local school classroom that a family is assigned to isn't right for everybody. And we should all just face up to that fact and give people options.
Testing, though, is still in a little bit of turmoil, and it's been so for a number of years. And so that means that there are students that have spent most, if not all, of their school years in a state that's sort of along those lines in transition when it comes to education. Does that concern you?
Yeah, it sure does. We've gone through Okay, I'll have full disclosure. I actually worked at the Department of Education before I was elected to the General Assembly, and I helped write the A-plus education program and then helped pass it in my first session in 1987. And it was cutting edge. I mean, it was cutting edge to have standardized testing that could measure Indiana to, you know, other states in the nation. It is not, it's not been a good program. We've struggled to try to make it right. We've, you know, tapped teachers to try to help us make it right, superintendents and parents, and I don't know that there's any right formula. In fact, as a joke, Matt, when we were talking about replacing iStep with iLearn, which is the current standardized testing, I proposed a new name that I was going to put in a bill. It was called I Quit, because it, you know, it just, it's difficult. I don't have a silver bullet. If I had a silver bullet, it would have been passed into law. So I don't know. And educators and education professionals are going to have to continue to help us try to focus in on that so that there can be, you can't improve what you aren't measuring. There does have to be a measurement. Are the measurements we're using now correct? Have to put that in the probably not category for me. So wish I had an answer.
We're talking with former House Speaker Brian Bosma, who is leaving the Indiana House of Representatives next Friday officially. We have a listener voicemail from David. Let's listen to that now.
Hello, Mr. Bosma. Congratulations on your retirement. This is David from Gary, Indiana. The question for you is the casino legislation that was a bipartisan agreement, surprisingly successful, and being a Gary resident, this region will be a direct beneficiary of that. Can you briefly describe that process? And congratulations.
Well, thank you, David. First of all, that's very kind. Well, I know I have a couple of friends listening, so when I heard David, I immediately thought of one of my friends. I thought it was going to be about my smart aleck comment I made earlier.
You didn't plant David. That's okay.
I did not. So there has been when I was first elected to the General Assembly, and when most of your listeners were casting their first votes, Indiana had no gaming whatsoever. There was nothing. And then in about 88-ish, maybe 87, I voted no. It was passed through the legislature to change the constitutional prohibition against lotteries. And it was, I was there for all those debates. It was stated that this is just for a lottery. It's not for anything more. And that passed the constitutional requirement in a referendum. And then the march for everything else in the world has in gaming has started. So we virtually have all possible forms of gaming now in Indiana. And we are the third or fourth highest generator of gaming revenues in the nation. So, and I'm not sure if it's third or it was fourth, and I think we squeaked into third behind New Jersey and Nevada. So we've got it all. And one of the things that we haven't had, of course, some of you will remember, we had river boats that actually had to go out, actually had to float and run and have a maritime crew, pass maritime Coast Guard inspections, et cetera. Then we started leaving them at the dock. Then we started closing the doors, and during the time they would go out. And then we took the motors out. Then we put props under them. Then we moved them onto land. And consequently, the prohibition on land-based casinos, which is what has kept one out of Gary and Indianapolis, was almost non-existent anymore because the former riverboats around the perimeter of the state were essentially on land. So it wasn't that far of a run to get to the location of the new Gary, casino, fully on inland, and both of the current Gary riverboat locations were, I don't want to say dicey, but let's just say they weren't optimal, okay, as an understatement. And so hopefully this will give, and Gary's struggling. There's no doubt about that. And struggling are a number of responsible mayors who've tried to do the right thing. So I think some felt this was helped them. And then the second, there was a unused license in Gary that is being moved to Terre Haute. So I know they're trying to put something together out there as well. So we'll see how that goes. And I guess you used to be able to say, and I said it many times, I was never an advocate for gaming expansion in our state. You said something, you know, this is an expansion of gaming. People ran for the hills. I said that two or three times this past year, and nobody batted an eye. So I guess Hoosiers were ready for it, and their elected officials responded accordingly.
We're spending the hour with Brian Bosma, the longest-serving House Speaker in the history of the Indiana General Assembly. His last day is next Friday, and we're reviewing some of the big moments in his career, specifically during his time as Speaker. There's a lot more to cover, and we'll do so next. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're spending the hour with one of the most powerful Indiana political figures of the last couple decades, now former House Speaker Brian Bosma, who gave up the mantle to Fisher's Republican Todd Houston back at the end of this year's session. Speaker Bosma will leave office at the end of next week after 34 years in the Indiana House of Representatives. So let's talk about another sort of...
I'm going to interrupt you, Matt. I had to laugh. You said who gave up the title to Fish... I didn't know you were going to say Fishers because I kind of gave up the title to Fish, too.
You think so? No. Todd Houston took over on March 9th. Let's talk about right to work. Very much a partisan issue. Very contentious with the Democratic walkout and the boycott. Do you think those moves by Democrats sent the message they wanted to? I mean, the reason that it happened, part of it anyway, was the supermajority. And they felt... I guess, like, they had to do something like that. Did that make you think twice at all?
So you've mixed two things. So we did not have a supermajority when we did right to work. So let me set it for you. 2011, we had 60 members. You need 67 to convene without others, right? So, well, which is why in 2011 they left the state. And because there were two things. Education scholarships, what we've called vouchers, three things really, a charter school expansion, those two that I was fighting for very hard, and then the third was right to work. And so the Democrats left. It was clear we were moving forward, we weren't going to stop, and Pat Bauer led his team to Champaign-Urbana, and they were there for 35 work days, which is the longest in the nation's history, the longest legislative walkout in the U.S. And we knew this because prior to that, 31-day walkout in Texas was touted as the longest in the nation. So there were up to 14,000 folks in the many from out of state, many who were paid to be there. There to protest at the State House while we said the Democrats were sitting around in a hot tub over in Champaign, you know, writing demands and having cocktails. It was actually a pretty cheesy hotel. It happened to be actually next door to a union hall, though, so the union hall would bring over food and that kind of thing. So a few funny stories out of that. We appropriated the protesters. The state police had an absolute fit. The Indianapolis Star had a picture of me wading out into hundreds upon hundreds of protesters and talking with them. And then I eventually opened the chambers, the House of the Floor, to allow the protesters to come in, sit down in the legislators' seats, sit along the side, and I started explaining the bill and what it would do for workers and how it didn't kill unions. It didn't take their pension away, as they were being told. It just gave them a choice that they could join the union or didn't have to if they chose not to. And they couldn't take dues out of your paycheck if you chose not to. Well, we started making headway with that. And there was one time when I'm having a group in like this that a guy jumped up and said, so-and-so, some union boss, just called and said, everybody has to get out of here, because people were listening and changing their minds. So the Pat Bauer, again, said he wanted to meet to negotiate his return. And I said, well, we can negotiate all we want, but the day you return, the calendar will be exactly as it was the day you left. And so he said, well, I want to negotiate. So it comes back. And he said, well, I want to negotiate. I said, that's fine. We sit right here. I'm leaving the doors open and the press can stand outside. So Nikki Kelly and Eric Berman and a bunch of the State House reporters that you would probably know literally stood at the two doors to my office while Pat, you know, just started giving me his list of demands, like 22 demands or something like that. And I said, well, we ended up taking right to work off the table, and that was the only thing we changed. We passed vouchers, we passed charter school expansion, three or four other things they didn't want. And then in 2012, I made right to work, Jerry Torr, as our primary author and advocate, and I carried the bill, and it was our number one, it was actually our only priority. And we knew they couldn't leave the state again because they had gotten so much bad press. And actually, the walkout, so we passed right to work, the 23rd state to do so. Another state hadn't done it for 15 years. And then the chips, the pins fell all over the country. A bunch of other states, after we did it and lived, then a bunch of other states did it. So then in that next election, because of the walkout, we came back with 70 members. And that walkout literally was the reason we still have a supermajority this day.
Mm. And on the lines of a supermajority, I'm sure you see it as a good thing for your party, but have you found a supermajority to be challenging to deal with in any way? You're laughing.
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it a good thing. So I've always said privately, and now I'm saying it over the radio statewide. I've served in 45, and I've served with 72 members in 56 is just about the sweet spot. You can let a couple people who, you know, it would be bad politically for them to vote for something to go, and then still not everyone is the 51st vote. So it probably the biggest challenge during my leadership tenure has been the 72, 70, and 69 majorities, because then you start getting factions and people don't feel as bonded. I mean, when we were in the minority and certain leaders treated us poorly and didn't follow the rules, I mean, that we got pretty tight, you know. It was our team against another team. And when you have so many, it's difficult to keep people focused on the same thing, coloring in the lines. So, yeah, it's a challenge. And, in fact, I began the session, whichever one it was that we had 70, telling from the rostrum in my org day speech that such a large majority requires us to be more accommodating to the minority rather than less, more communicative rather than less. And it puts a heavy responsibility on us. And honestly, I've gotten a lot of credit from a lot of different corners, including from the Democrat side, about keeping supermajorities in line with the volatile and still accomplishing what we all agree needs to be accomplished. With the volatility of the political scene right now, I have no idea if Speaker Houston is going to have the challenge of a supermajority in the future or if it will be less than that. I've never considered a supermajority critical to accomplishing what I hope we accomplish. And I will tell you, next year is a redistricting year. And the census is going to be delayed. So there will be just a special session on redistricting sometime in July or August or September. That's a horrible thing. So I'm hoping for Speaker Houston that he will have a supermajority to work with. So so people don't get the idea to head to Illinois again.
Ellen left us a comment on Facebook. She says, please ask Speaker Bozma about his opinion on supermajorities and whether he thinks they're healthy for democracy.
Well, I think I just gave my opinion.
I think you did.
They are. But there have to be leaders to come to reasonable conclusions. And the problem with a supermajority is, and we have, I don't see anything, I haven't, nothing has leapt to my attention, let's say that, where we truly overreached and came to a conclusion that we wouldn't have come to if we had 54 members rather than 67 today. Because a lot of the ideas, most ideas that come to the General Assembly fall by the wayside, either of their own weight or because someone in the leadership role organizes it to happen that way. So there have to be responsible leaders to take charge of that. I'm confident Senator Bray, Speaker Houston, and their counterparts on the minority sides are all responsible people who have an agenda, but also want to do what's right for the state and realize that Republican, Democrat, Green Party, we're all Hoosiers, and we can disagree, but we all have to live together, accomplish what's good for the state.
Let's look at the same-sex marriage debate. Ideas around that issue were changing at that time in the Republican Party to a degree. And now, of course, marriage equality is here. What do you think of the issue now? Have your thoughts changed?
You know, the Supreme Court has spoken. So what I think about it doesn't really necessarily matter. We're living with a Supreme Court ruling, and everyone needs to, it's the law of the land. And until that should change, that's how we have to conduct ourselves. People bring a lot of different viewpoints. This is probably the one area that there's been an evolution. It was almost not just an evolution, it was almost a revolution in society where it was an unusual circumstance for Republican or Democrat to support anything other than marriage between a man and a woman. And then that just took a sharp change. And so it was difficult. And I'd say the Republican Party probably changed late on that, and some still are in the same position they've always been for religious or other reasons. And that is absolutely their right to have that opinion, just as it was the right of the people that had a differing opinion when it wasn't a majority opinion to hold that opinion. So, it's really not much of a debate today because someone to make a debate because it's the law of the land.
Along those lines, it's been 5 years since RFRA, but a lot of Hoosiers and non-Hoosiers still remember it pretty vividly. Any reflection on how that went and how it could have or maybe should have gone differently?
Sure, I will. And there's the backstory on this one, too. First of all, the RFRA statute was truly innocuous. It codified into Indiana law what was already case law. And a group of 17 law professors from around the country, including both of the IU law schools here in Notre Dame, and Harvard, and all over the place, wrote a letter, and many of whom, it said in their letter, many of us support same-sex marriage. We have these different viewpoints, but we all agree the case law should be codified have this provision with respect to freedom of religion versus, really what it is a state action versus personally and honestly held religious belief when those two things collide. So it didn't do many of this. They didn't provide for active discrimination, any of this. I mean, it doesn't matter now because everybody believes it did. But here's the backstory. There was legislation was proceeding on this in about 17 states. And there was a national group that had organized national forces to pounce on the first state that enacted this new RFRA that was proceeding in all these different states. And I can't remember if it was North Carolina or South Carolina now. I think it was North Carolina. North Carolina was scheduled to be the first one to adopt the legislation. And then they had some procedural snafu that delayed it for a week, delayed a hearing for a week or something like this. And Indiana ended up being the first one to pass the legislation. And then the onslaught occurred from all over the country, actually all over the world. There were more press people from all over the country in Indiana than any other, probably in our state's history. And it was national news. Would have been national news for North Carolina if they hadn't had a procedural, if we hadn't been so efficient here. So David Long, this then Senate president, and I, we were approached by a number of business people. I mean, Lilly, Cummins, these are huge employers in our state, in addition to a lot of advocacy groups, and say, look, we got to have a solution. You know, IU Health, Dan Evans. I mean, it's a community leader after community leader that said this has to be resolved, or we're going to be in very dire straits here. So we took bull by the horns on that one and came up with the solution that we're living under today, and that is out in the hinterlands where you don't have local ordinances, you have the provisions of RFRA apply, but if you're in a community that has adopted the human rights ordinance, which I have no idea what number now, maybe 40, have adopted, then you have to abide by the human rights ordinance, like the one in Marion County that says you cannot discriminate based on gender identity or sexual orientation, a few others. And so it's not a bad place to land. It's an issue mostly in urban areas. It tends not to be an issue in rural areas, and that's kind of how we shook out in the end. And that was the RFRA, quote, fix that we ended up with. Again, I'll give you another backstory that few people know. So
quickly.
So Governor Pence wasn't thrilled with this. Greg Louganis, a very strong gay activist now, tried to come to a press conference in which the governor was going to address this issue. He wasn't allowed. They didn't know who he was. He doesn't look like the Greg Louganis that, you know, we all saw jumping off the platform. Anyway, he was denied entry to the press conference, and one of my folks was there and said, well, do you want to go watch this press conference with the speaker? So Greg Louganis and his dog, Fifi, I think was its name, and I and a couple of others watched the governor's press conference there. He's since written me a couple of nice letters and some social media stuff. So there's just always something funny happening around all these things that looks so tragic.
In the last 30 seconds that we have, which may not be enough time to answer this, but I'm going to try anyway. So Indiana's House Democratic Caucus is mostly women now, and that is not the case for the GOP. And so your party has its diversity leadership series to address those kinds of issues. How effective do you think it's been, given those that reality?
Well, there's been an active opportunity to recruit both minorities and especially women into the House. Everybody I recruited got promoted. Sue Elsperman, I recruited to run for the House. She served with us 4 years and is the president of Ivy Tech. Suzanne Crouch was on our team. She's now the lieutenant governor. Of course, Becky Skillman was lieutenant governor, was in the Senate. So it definitely needs to be done. And I support Chairman Huffer's actions on that, and the Lugar series especially is great for women.
Speaker Bosma, I want to thank you for agreeing to spend the hour with us today. Congratulations on your career, and we wish you the best in the years to come.
Thank you, Matt. I've enjoyed it greatly. Thanks.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed this theme. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.